We're holding Rav Eliyahu Kitov's book, the chapter on Shalom Bayit, peace in the home. And we're up to Darchei Tguva, ways of reaction. And the way our class was supposed to be, the last few months we've been off schedule, we're supposed to begin with Rav Eliyahu Kitov and then go on to other discussions. Darchei Tguva, you didn't find it? One pass to me. Page 58 in the English version. How to react to problems. Adam shiroe beveito davar megunesh chayvim limchot alav. If a person sees something which is shameful, something that's improper in his home, that there has to be a reaction to. Really, there should be a reaction to. He has to protest. Im samuch libo, if he is confident, and he is certain that he has no intent in his reaction and in his rebuke other than the sake of heaven, so that thing won't be repeated, so that the family members won't say, he saw and he was quiet. People sometimes say that. You saw that I did it. You saw. You didn't say anything. People say, it seemed like you didn't mind, so I did it again. So sometimes we have to react. Then he does have to react against this thing that is wrong, if he is certain that his reaction is Hashem Shemayim, and it is for the sake that the thing won't be repeated. But he must be very careful that the reaction should be correct. And the room won't be greater than what it is coming to fix. And most often, you should know, that is the case. Most often when people react, even if they think they're L'shem Shemayim, I would say most often they're not. And even if they are L'shem Shemayim, in most instances, the reaction bears more problems, the results are more problematic than they fix. I always say as a rule, ask yourselves, how many times did you react today? How many times didn't you react? If you reacted more than once, twice, maximum three times, you're off. Something here is wrong. Can't be. There are so many things that the Shem Shemayim need a reaction, and you're reacting properly and everything's right. Impossible. In my opinion. I was once present when a parent, his son, wanted to go to Davin. And his son was going to go in shorts and not dressed nicely. So the parent said, you have to get dressed nicely. We're going to them. We're going to shul. And the kid said, okay. And the parent said, yeah, and I told you this before. And shul is starting in 2 minutes. If you don't get there on time, I start hearing the threats. Is he really gaining in chinuch of the child? Is that really the way to be mechanech a child? To start threatening and yelling? So the kid won't be there on time. Is that really what we have to fight about? Is that what it's worth giving all the threats about? One of the things parents have to remember, even assuming that everything else is right, sometimes parents go all out. And they forget, what are you going to do when the kid does something worse? I mean, is this really the worst thing a kid can do? You're threatening him with a snack for not showing up to minyan on time? What's going on here? And the rule is that kids usually do worse. Whatever you think is the worst thing he's ever done, almost definitely there will be a circumstance where you have to have a stronger reaction to what he's done. So if you smack him 15 times now, what are you going to do next? Punch him in the face? Well, what exactly are you going to do? Certain things, and we up the ante, both in our relationship with our spouse and with our children. Meaning, if a person reacts quietly when things bother him, then when he yells, it'll have meaning. But if a person is yelling often, so then when he yells, it loses the meaning. So he has to figure out something else. So he'll screech. So he'll threaten. I'm not joking. You hear this. I was walking past the home one evening, and I start hearing yelling. And the husband tells his wife, what do you think? You don't care that I yell? Today I went to the Rabbanut. I filed for divorce. So this poor husband reached a point where he felt like nothing he says is of value, so he brings the next threat, which we've already discussed many times, that's not a threat. That's just destruction. But people sometimes forget that if you're going to move up, if you're going to keep upping the ante, then at some point you're not going to have anything left. And the better way to do it is to keep everything down, even in big things, to try and keep it down so that when there are bigger things, we'll still have where to go. You want something, Eitan? הרבה דרכים של תגובה יש. There are many ways to react. חזקת היד, גערה, בתייה, תוכחה, הסברה, בקשה ותחנונים, שתיקה של רוגז ושתיקה של צער. Person can roar, a person can rebuke, a person can explain, a person can ask, a person can beg, a person can be silent out of anger, a person can be silent out of pain. There are different expressions which a person can use to convey his dissatisfaction. And כל דרכי התגובה האלה וכל שביניהם ודומיהם אין לך אחת מהם שאין לה מקום ואין לה שעה. All these different reactions, there can be circumstances where that's what's right. And even the reactions that are between these reactions, there can be a time where that is the right reaction. And you can't give rules when it comes to this. הכל לפי מה שהוא אדם. It depends on where he's holding, where she's holding, where the relationship is holding. Depends on many things. Our sages said that sometimes when a person is angry, he may break a vessel, the Gemara says, to show the people of the house that he's angry for something bad that he's seeing. Omnam, but when our sages permitted this, they didn't let a person come in and bash a vase out of anger. They said if you have a broken vase, if you have a vessel that's broken, that you may break. You have to have enough control in your anger to ensure that you're not breaking something whole. Chazal said, oh, you have a shard of shard of ceramic here, and you want to bash it out to make your point. If the time is right and everything 100%, that's what's needed, okay. So long as it's broken, you have enough control to make sure that it's broken. And, we'll see just one second, let's just finish the sentence. They only permitted with a broken vessel. Only a person who inside is still calm. They only permitted it when he has to show that he means it externally, but internally he's calm. Not that he's breaking it out of anger, but that he's calm. He hasn't let the anger take control of him. He's calm, and he has to show the anger to convince people. There was once a Rebbe in the yeshiva I was in elementary school, who never showed anger. So it was a very good trait, but he didn't get control of the class. He sometimes has to show anger. Sometimes a parent has to yell. My wife and I sometimes have situations where what the children do is so funny that we feel like laughing and not yelling, but the kid needs to be yelled at. He doesn't need to laugh. So sometimes we'll yell and walk into the other room and laugh because he can't see us laughing. He needs to be yelled at. But you have to do it when you're in control. You can't, if you're not in control, you can't yell. Yeah.
Why is it usually showing anger, you're breaking something, but yet we step on the cup, and that doesn't show anger, shows lack of sadness.
The idea of breaking a cup at a wedding goes back to a story that the Gemara records. It's not a question of anger. It's a question of when there was once a wedding that everyone participating was getting so happy, they forgot that we're in a state that we don't have the temple, that we don't have full happiness. So one of the rabbis took a piece of glass that was made of a special white glass that could not be found after the destruction of the temple. It was really a rare antique that everyone valued. And he took it before everyone, and he broke it. And when everyone saw that, then people said, oh, wait, why'd you do that?
Also, there's a question, why nowadays is it that you get the opposite response?
So I felt in my wedding I wanted to give a speech before I broke the glass. I didn't do it because I didn't want to invent a new minhag. No one does it, so I didn't do it. But I felt like
everybody knows the reason behind it, yet everybody, that's like what symbolizes the, like when you cut the ribbon, something new. Something that symbolizes it, but it's, in reality it should not be the case.
So that's why in Israel today the custom is that they sing in Mishkechech Yerushalayim after breaking the glass. That's why some chatanim break it beforehand. And people get upset. No, break it after the song. No, break it before the song, like you say. It shouldn't be that straight after the breaking, everyone says Mazel Tov and starts dancing. Right? There's a lot of logic to that, yeah? So, the Gemara only permitted a person to break a vessel that's already broken when the person is in full control and he's not really angry. He's only showing a face of anger. Mishumkach, therefore, kashim dvoim ele lumabim klalim. It's difficult to give rules when it comes to these things. Afal pichen nitan leavchin b'neim avchanot klaliot. Nonetheless, we can give certain general guidelines, and we can say, this is a lesser reaction, this is a more difficult reaction, this most people gain from, this most people do not gain from. This has a greater danger built in, and this has a lesser danger built in. These first reactions that we mentioned, person clenching a fist, giving a roar, they are certainly of the more difficult reactions that a person can have. And most people will not bear any fruit from such a reaction, and the danger of using such a reaction is very great. The Gemara says that we saw in last week's Mishlei, Tova tochachat b'mevin me'akot kesil me'a. A roar in one that has understanding is better than 100 lashes to a fool. So Rav Kitov explains, it can only work if the one that's giving the roar has the understanding to weigh correctly his roar. And the one that's receiving the roar can accept it well. And if not, or when in doubt, then one should refrain. Because the danger of using these harsh reactions is much greater than is worth playing with. The Gemara quotes that Rabbi Zera was asked, why'd you live a long life? So one of the things Rabbi Zera said was, I was never angry in my home. Within my home, I never was upset. So this can be a general guideline for everyone, that if people behave this way, or they accept to behave this way, then they could rest assured that they won't be upset and they won't lose. The greatest way of rebuke is being silent when one gets angry, and being silent when one's upset. The power of silence when one shows that he's pained is strong, and it makes an indelible impact on the heart of those that love him, much more than saying something 1,000 times. We have to remember that one of the foundations of our relationship is that there is mutual care. And if I show that I'm pained, so I'm giving a much stronger message than having said something. When one adds to that rebuke that's measured after he is no longer angry, but that's said at the proper time, and there's no better time than the time that we feel close, then if one makes mention of something, then it has an impact. And we discussed once the rules of when we can make a comment. We said one has to make it when we feel closest to one another. One has to make it not when there's external stress. One has to make it when the situation is not present. Meaning, once it's in reaction to a situation, then the other side gets defensive. It's in reaction to something. One has to make it as though it's a one-time occurrence. If we say it as though that's a common thing, so the common answer is going to be, okay, you're right, I do this all the time. That's who you married. Tough luck. You're stuck. That's the classical answer. If you come and prove this happened 100 times, 100 times that A, B, and C. So the answer is going to be, yep, you're right. Okay. Now what? What can a person say? So when we have to make mention of something, then the trick is to wait and then make mention of it like it was a one-time thing. You remember when such and such happened? And one has to be prepared with many, many, many solutions. Meaning we can't just come and say this is the problem. We have to be prepared to come and say, look, this is what happened, and I want us to think it through together. And I was thinking, and afterwards, after we discuss it, I was thinking maybe this is a possible way to resolve it, or maybe this is another way to overcome it. One has to come with many possible solutions. And it's a good idea when we ask of our spouse to work on something to, at the same time, think of something that we know we have to work on and that's difficult for us to work on, and then say, and you know what? It's not that I'm perfect. I also, A, B, and C. So why don't we agree that while you work on X, Y, I'll work on A, B. And this way we're working on something together. This helps us to recognize when the other side doesn't live up to what we would want them to live up to. We'll see how many times we don't live up to what we would want to. Very often, and all too often, we have expectations and we forget the human factor. We forget how difficult it is for us to live up to our expectations of ourselves. Most people come every Rosh Hashanah with the same list of things they want to fix this year. It's rare that a person says, yeah, I did that one. New thing I have to work on this year. Most people, every year, are working on the same things. So that sort of indicates that we're not so successful at changing our nature, acquiring new traits. And it's very easy to expect for someone else to change. Because my wife's uncle teaches in a yeshiva called TAB, which is for guys in Brooklyn who have all kinds of issues. Sometimes they did drugs, sometimes they have different things that they want to work out. And he said in a speech once, he said, people look at people who need to do tshuva, people who live a lifestyle that's not an observance of Torah and mitzvos, and they think, why can't you just change? Why can't you just do differently? Don't you know this is what's right? And if we think to ourselves, when was the last time we tried to get up 10 minutes earlier? Just on a habit to change our sleep schedule, to get up earlier, to come to davening earlier. Most people can't change 10 minutes of their lives. So to look at someone else and say change your whole life, when we can't look in the mirror and say we could change 10 minutes of our lives or change something so small as our sleeping habits, we have to remember it's difficult to make any change. Any act of rebuke, says Rav Kitov, has to be connected with shalom. And only then can it be given correctly and accepted in a true fashion. A person might say, you know, this is difficult. How could I live up to such a thing? So tell him, you know what? Any person who wants to lives up to difficult things in life. Life expects us to live up to difficult things. When a person gets old, it's difficult. And when a person has to deal with parnasa, it's difficult. Raising children is even more difficult. Living with the social obligations we have is difficult. And living with the governmental obligations we have, taxes and things like that, is even more difficult. Nonetheless, no one says, I can't do this. This is difficult. I got to pay taxes. I got to stop at a red light. I got to renew my registration and my license. We have a lot of obligations to the law. We have a lot of obligations to society. We have obligations to our family and our children. And we don't shrug those obligations and say, this is difficult. I'm not doing it. Keeping shalom bayit, keeping peace in the home, is one of our obligations. And a person can't say, well, it's difficult and I can't do it. What a person has to do is strengthen himself to adopt good habits. And when a person feels like he's at a point of test, then, and this is key for all our lives, a person has to think, this is the only time I'm going to have to deal with this test. One of the things that cause us to have frustration and give up, and this is true also with dealing with our roommate or our spouse, is that we feel like this situation is recurring. Again she said things that are my private issue in front of someone else. Again I told her a secret and she told someone else. Again she made a joke at my expense. If we thought of it as a one-time thing, she's never going to do it again. She just did it now. If we think of it as a one-time thing, so then a person would be able to gather his strength and stand up to the test. Okay, I'm going to keep quiet. Maybe we'll discuss it later. Maybe not right now. I'm not going to react. Just like it's not right what she said about me in front of other people, it's not right I should react in front of other people. So if a person would take a situation which is difficult and think of it as a one-time thing, and this is true for any test the person is put to, if a person would think, this is the only time, let me live up to this, or like we gave from Rav Zelig Pliskin in our earlier class, if a person would think, there are 100,000 spectators, he's in the middle of Coliseum, and he's at the Olympics, and if he's going to live up to the test, he's going to hear 100,000 people jump to their feet, a standing ovation, he could stand up to any test, so long as he thinks of it as a one-time thing. And the weakest person could stand up to tests when he approaches it this way. The Gemara tells us that there were two people that every Erev Shabbos, the Satan would enter their homes, and on every Erev Shabbos, they'd have fights. All the neighbors would know, everyone in the neighborhood heard, these two people, every Friday afternoon, are getting into fights. So Rabbi Meir once came to town, and for 3 weeks he was present in their home Friday afternoon, the late afternoon. And when he was around, so it's not nice to start yelling and shouting in front of Rabbi Meir, the great Rabbi Meir. So after 3 weeks that he ensured they wouldn't fight, there was peace, permanent peace between these two neighbors. And Rabbi Meir heard the Sutton wailing, "Whoa, Rabbi Meir took me out of my home." So when a person tries to overcome, Hashem helps him in his tests. When a person stands up to a difficult situation once, so from heavens they help him to stand up the second time. He stands up to it twice, then the third time will be easier. And once he gets it three times, then he's already on the right path. Rabbi Meir wanted to kick the Sutton of Machlokas out of his home, what he called his home, between these two people. So he was able to kick him out three times, and for three times he was able to weaken him. So then the angel of peace already rested. He inherited the place. There are certain things that a person could do to help ensure himself not to get angry, not to fight. Each person has to find what's going to help him, what's fitting for his traits. There was the Chafetz Chaim, they say, used to go into a corner and talk to himself whenever he felt himself get angry. There are some rabbis that say when a person gets angry, he should look at his tzitzis. The tzitzis are supposed to remind us of mitzvos. There was a certain Talmud Chacham that he had a special garment that he wore when he got angry. So he said, whenever I want to get angry, I'm allowed to get angry. I just have to go change my clothing. When I put those clothing on, then I could get angry. By the time he got to his dresser, took off his clothes, put on the other garment, he had already calmed down. So we always have to try to find ways of taking control of ourselves. A person tells himself, don't get angry, so very often he won't win. If a person tells himself, okay, I could get angry, but I have to do a certain thing beforehand. Like this Talmid Chacham said, I have to go change my clothing. So we could always wait a little bit. There was someone who was fighting Lashon Hara, that they decided, you know what I'm doing? Anytime I want to say Lashon Hara, I tell myself, it was to their spouse, so that's always more difficult. You always want to share with your spouse what's going on. So they decided, the way I'm doing it is, whenever I want to say Lashon Hara to my spouse, I say, I'll tell him tomorrow. I'll tell him. Usually when we have a juicy piece of information, if we've waited 24 hours, by 24 hours later, say to ourselves, what am I, nuts? Is it worth eating chazer? So many lavim just to say this? Is it really that juicy? But it's always the spur of the moment, like Tamar told Amnon. If you could only look to the future, if you could only see what you're going to pay, what I'm going to pay, what the cost of this is going to be, stop. Think for a second. Yeah. Granted, that's why we began the chapter with the concept that sometimes there does have to be a reaction. But the reaction has to be measured. If a person will control himself, then he can later react in a measured way, in a way that's going to be most conducive. No? Doesn't that make sense? Yeah, do you really think so?
What would be the alternative? You're going to look him up in the phone book and call him and say, you know, that wasn't very nice, or, you know, or as opposed to saying, listen, you can't say that, you can't speak that way. It's just not going to work.
Yeah, but what's the gain and what's the loss? What's the gain? Like, I need to hear an example. I'm not sure what you mean.
If somebody shares some information about you in public that is really not supposed to be shared, and it's embarrassing, confident in himself for whatever reason, they're mudslinging whatever, and sometimes this person should be dealt with, you know, right on the spot, you know, and told very clearly, you know, this kind of, you can't act this way.
For what purpose? So I'm saying,
make sometimes people need to make it clear, very clearly, right on the spot, in order to
set boundaries, right?
Yeah,
to say, hey, this is my boundary, and if you cross it, there's going to be consequences. And then just as a form of din, yeah?
Yeah, the question is, are you really gaining? Like, I'm not sure of the examples you give.
You shouldn't react that angry. You should just say, listen, my friend, listen.
I was on a bus once. And I was holding my little boy's hand. Okay, he's 3 years old. And this man comes lugging through with his luggage, and he tries to mow over my son. So I tell him, wait a second, there's a little boy here. So the man says, look where you put him, and continues mowing over my son. So I say, wait a second, what do you mean look where you put him? You're mowing over my son. So the, like, yeah, if I wouldn't speak up then, the kid would be mowed over with this luggage. So sometimes you have to talk. I mean, I can't wait and say, come back to him in the back of the bus and say, hey, that wasn't very nice. You just like mowed over my son. That's ridiculous. He said, I don't remember the exact language. He tried to make fun of the fact that I was trying to get him to stop mowing over my son. So I answered him. I don't remember what he said and what I said. But I remember that it was a sharp enough line that I answered him that he had to stop and smile. And he did stop. I don't remember. I just don't remember the line. I don't remember what his line was. But I felt like if I'm not going to answer this guy, he's just going to keep going. I can't let the kid get mowed over. So I answered him. I put him in his place. And the whole bus heard the conversation. And he made it look like I was like weird because my son is actually standing in a place on the bus. So I answered him, and then he was embarrassed, and he stood in his place. I don't remember what it was, but I saw if I'm not going to answer him, if I'm not going to put him in his place, the kid's going to get mowed over. Okay, sometimes you have no choice. But in most circumstances, the question is, what's the gain, what's the loss, and what's the need? There was once a person speaking, and he made fun of the Lubavitcher Rebbe. He was speaking in a public forum, and this was when the Lubavitcher Rebbe was still alive, and people were saying that he's going to be Mashiach, and he got up in a public forum and spoke, and he made a joke. And a rabbi who was present, who was no Lubavitcher, got up and put the man in his place. He said, you don't come close to his toenail, and if you don't recognize that, you shouldn't be out there talking. This is he felt, this rabbi, that, and he was no Lubavitcher, but he felt that you can't let a person mock even if you don't agree with the Lubavitcher Rebbe, but to mock him in public like this, if he's sitting there quietly, that's not right. So he got up, and everyone, it was a dinner where like he was risking a lot by saying it because he was representative of the organization. And he was putting their honoree in his place. And that's their honoree that he's talking that way to. They felt he has to. So sometimes, but I think most of the time, we're protecting our own honor, which is important sometimes. But usually, when we're working out of protecting our own honor, we're going to go too far. It's my honor you're talking about. That's no small thing.
You shouldn't be done out of anger, right? Because we know nothing really good comes out of anger.
Not only should you be done out of anger. It has to be weighed. What's the gain and what's the loss?
What about, you didn't speak about the issue I mentioned about inertia. If a person is just an nasty person, then he sees he can get away with it. Then, you know, when the ball gets rolling, so he got away with it once, twice. Hey, this is
so
great.
We
have
to.
I'm getting a lot of laps and kicks, you know.
We have to discern between a continuing relationship and a one-time thing.
Okay.
Like, that's where these things are difficult. Like
okay, one-time thing. So
a one-time thing. Again, a person doesn't have to let his rights be trampled on. At the same time, the example you gave seems like what's done is done. What are you going to gain? Like, if someone said something he shouldn't have said, okay, it was said, now what? What are you going to gain by getting back at him? Now, if it's an ongoing relationship, so then I don't understand why the same reaction can't happen when a person is more calm and has had time to think it through and think through what's the best way to approach the person. To get, or privately, right? Usually when you make a confrontation in public, so then each one is more apt to protect their honor and less apt to go for the truth. Whereas if you come to the person privately and say, look, I want you to know, just said it was hurtful for me, I don't think it was fair. I don't think it's fair for you to expect, if you feel like you should add this, and this is again, you're entering confrontation, but sometimes one could add, I don't think it's fair for you to expect that next time I hear this, I'm going to keep quiet. But then you have to weigh, halachically, are you going to really be able to answer? Should you answer? Just because he's insulting you, are you allowed to insult him? What are you allowed to do? It's not so simple. So yeah, a person shouldn't allow himself to be trampled on. But what yes... So what yes will depend on the situation.
You don't see a difference between insulting back and saying, you know, you cannot speak, you just can't speak things like, you don't see a difference between
I think, fine, that's fair. I've had situations where I've said, I don't think it's fair to have this conversation here. You have something against me, let's talk about it. But why do it in front of everyone? No? Isn't that... I'm not insulting him. I'm just saying, wait a second. Why are you bashing me in front of everyone else? Yeah, we'll talk about it one-on-one. What's that?
How do we understand the end of Amidah?
No, what?
And it's all that the one man should be like that.
Yes,
and that should
yes,
not
that's
the.
Fine for me.
There
you go.
And it's also that like, actually no.
Yeah.
Actually, so that.
So we have to sit down, and I don't think we're understanding it the same way. You're understanding that when we say in Shmoneh Esrei, Nafshiki Afar Lakol Tiyeh, I should be like dust, and everyone should step all over me. That's what you're understanding? So that's not what I'm understanding.
Well, to a certain extent, I do not know
exactly.
So what does it mean?
It means that it's a humble view, right? It just I don't want to step. Not everyone should step on me, but I don't want to be pushed into the front or to.
Let's just open something up. Just a thought. I'm not. We have to sit and analyze what we're saying there. What is nafshi? What's afal? What's ke'afal? What's lakol? And what's tiyeh? We have to define each of those words. But let's just open a line of thought. Avram Avinu was told that Avram Avinu said, "Vanochi afal ve'efel." He said, "I'm dust. I'm ash." And then he stood up and spoke. And argued with their bonjour. And one bargain. Wait a second. Dust. What are you doing? What are you talking? Dust doesn't talk. If you're dust, you're going to be trampled over. God said, there's a decree. The city of Sodom and Amorah, those five cities are going to be wiped out. And David and Avraham Avinu comes to talk. And he begins his speech by saying, I'm dust. I'm worthless. And then he starts talking. Okay, so then what is that afa? And the Rambam writes, as we will learn, Bezat Shem... And Friday we're starting a Gil Teiman Bezrat Hashem. So the Rambam writes that the idea of the Jewish people being compared to the earth is that man spends his lifetime stepping on earth, and man ends his lifetime with the earth stepping on him for the rest of eternity. And so too the Jewish people spend their time in this world being stepped on, and all the nations are up and we're at the bottom. And in the end, just as the ground finally decomposes the body that has been stepping on its whole lifetime, so too, eventually, in the world to come, there's a promise that we won't be wiped out and we will overcome.
Just this issue of anava
nachna. Oh, so we have to define, what does it mean anava? Moshe Rabbeinu was anav, does that mean he let people step all over him? Moshe Rabbeinu was the humblest person, and yet when Korach and his men got up, Moshe Rabbeinu answered them. He kept trying to come towards them and make peace, but he didn't let them do what was wrong. He said, I never took a thing from these people, from anyone. Yeah?
So, just like in the case of the rabbi, somebody came against the rabbi, the one rabbi, and then somebody else told the rabbi, stood up and said, you come to this story. So, the reason is because at that point, you have to disprove what he's saying. So, let's even in terms of you, somebody saying something about you. So at that point, you had to say something that showed that what he's saying is incorrect, or else...
Sometimes, yeah. I once dated a girl, and I was really pressured to date this girl. So her family members, her cousins, or wasn't cousins, it was relations, they all pressured me to date this girl. And we go on the date, and like from the minute she saw me with a black yarmulke, she decided that it isn't for me, what they set me up with this guy for. So we go on the date, and we start talking, and everything I say, she puts on a sour face, like I said, something ridiculous. Okay, we end the date, and I decided maybe she had a bad day. I was willing to go out on another date. And she said no. She said, no. And then I come to these friends of mine who set me up, and I wasn't going to say a word. And at the end of the meal, they start giving me a speech. You know, we set you up with a really nice girl. Why don't you give it a shot? Why don't you try some more? What? So after I see that they're like really giving it in to me, I didn't want to say anything. I felt like, I don't know what story she sold them. But I realized that I'm at a point where these people aren't going to set me up again. They think I'm ridiculous. So I said, look, I agreed to a second date. She said no. Oh, now the whole story is different.
No, but let's say when you were stopping earlier, then they also did make fools of themselves by continuing on and on and on about how they...
I didn't realize how far they'd go on and on and on. I didn't realize how they took it to heart, like I said no to their relative.
But sometimes you have to disprove the guy's credibility by...
question is, how important is the issue? Like, why is it so important? Most issues we talk about aren't so important. And most of the time, you're going to have the same credibility if you say, you know, maybe you're right. Maybe I didn't see it correctly. No, and half the time, you're not going to lose credibility by saying that.
Perhaps not.
You're going to gain. You'll be viewed as more mature. The Gemara says that in an argument, the one that gives in first is the one that has better yichus. If you see two families and they have a constant argument, the sign of better yichus, the sign that one has better lineage, is that he gives in. That he's willing to accept that someone else might be right. Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel, we pask him like Beis Hillel, because whenever Beis Hillel would quote the two opinions, they'd quote Beis Shammai first. They'd give first analysis to the opposing opinion. So most of us aren't holding there. We're busy getting the other person to understand that we're right. So he gave an example where someone's trying to defame us, someone's trying to hurt us, where it has nothing to do with what's right. So that's a different story. But if it's a question of an argument, and so he thinks it was this way and I think it was that way, so he won on the ninth inning, he scored a home run the ninth inning, the eighth inning, maybe he's right. You know, okay, so I know he's wrong. But so what? You have it on many issues that are really not relevant. People sometimes feel pious when they sit at a speech and the person quotes a verse, they could correct them about how to quote it or where it's located. Fools! Well, you corrected a person, you embarrassed them publicly, what'd you gain? People will very often correct the speaker. It's very hard to speak and get it right. When you're speaking, there's pressure. Very often, a pasuk that you could quote in the middle of your sleep, you can't quote when you're standing in front of a public, in front of an audience. But if someone corrects him, so let's say they're right. So what? Not always are they right. But the people sometimes feel like they have to. I'm not so sure that all the instances that people feel they have to, they really have to. Okay, what's really at stake other than our honor? And our honor, again, there's a difference between someone trying to defame us, someone trying to make fun of us. And even there, sometimes if we just join the crowd and laugh, maybe they're right. And there's a difference between that and just like you weren't even there, what's it about that's so important? Okay, is it always important to win the argument? Why? If it's my honor, yeah. But if I'm looking for truth, so, okay. Yeah.
A lot of times it's very common if you want to win an argument, at the worst, you give the opposing argument in a biased way and then give your enlightened answer. or at least give a fair answer of the opposition and then give your enlightened answer. So it's normally with the opposing opinion first and then give the clear, true answer.
I think Beis Hillel, when they quoted Beis Shammai's opinion first, it was in a true fashion.
Yeah. But for us, we shouldn't take less from
that. So no, I disagree with you. I often feel that one of the keys to resolving issues is trying to explain to the other person what they are saying. Let me make sure I understood you correctly. It's one of the things I think people should do when they go to a doctor. You go to a doctor and he tells you something. So we forget nearly 50% of what we heard 15 minutes after we walk out of the doctor's office, 5 minutes after we walk out of the doctor's office. Now, there are real statistics on this. So I always recommend, come in with your questions ready, write down the answers, come in with someone else so you can both listen to the doctor, and when you're finished, repeat to the doctor or with the rabbi. People come to the rabbi and ask a question. Half the time they walk out of the rabbi and they have the wrong conclusion. It's very often it happens this way. They think the rabbi said this. He didn't say that. It's happened to me too. So what I've learned is that when I ask a question, after I get the answer, I say, okay, so what the Rav said is A, B, and C because of D, E, and F. In the following circumstances, this is the ruling. And right when I walk out of the office, I sit down and write it all down. Rav Haberstam Zatzal, I have notebooks. I'd walk into him, ask a question, I'd walk out, I'd sit down and write everything down. By the time I got home, I didn't remember it. And when I speak on the phone with the rabbi, I'm writing as I talk to him. I'm writing, because then I could write down everything in front of a rabbi, so some rabbis will let you, and some rabbis don't have the time, because it takes you longer. And they just can't. But a very good way of making sure you understood the other party is by repeating what they said. And Beis Hillel did that. Yosef, want something? No?
Just perhaps some reduction would be possibly also the situation of the Mechalel the
Yeah.
What?
That rabbi felt that this was a desecration of it was a chilul Hashem for someone to stand up there and make fun of the Lubavitcher Rebbe. So even though he was the yeshiva's honoree, the yeshiva The rabbi had to get up and say.
I call that you're allowed to insult him in front of other people. You aren't.
He yelled that he was. I don't know the exact circumstance. I wasn't there. I heard the story quoted.
Of course he yelled. But would you recommend us such behavior? No, you could tell us.
Us? There are usually people who know more around. Let them make the call. I think most of the time there's someone bigger than us present, and we shouldn't give a halachic ruling in front of someone else.
But you can give this person himself the chance the next time to stand up and say, I'm sorry for what I said. You don't have to insult me in front of other people. You can say, I made a joke, what's wrong, I'm sorry.
Okay.
Why are you insulting?
In the military, we used to have a saying that we roared in public and we rebuke in private.
Yeah, that's also a...
In the military, we have a saying that if I'm going to reprimand somebody, I take him aside from his peers. And if I'm going to do it right. Mm-hmm. And if I'm going to reward him, I'm going to do him in front of his peers.
Yeah. So Rav Kitov ends this section, Adam Sheminago Kach, a person who behaves like this, and he's careful not to let his anger take control of him, but he's in control. He merits and he sees his home as a sukkah of peace from which peace emanates and lights up the world outside. A person who behaves this way in his home will ultimately be king of his home, and he'll be awarded the crown of kingship. People in his home will want to listen to him, and he won't have to worry about what's going on in his home and the troubles of his home. A house that's built on the foundations of peace and truth, that's a house from which is fitting that the nation will be built and that kings will come from that house.
Amen.
Next week, Bezrat Hashem, we're going to learn about the mitzvah of lighting candles on Shabbos and its connection with peace. That Chazal instituted our lighting candles, and that's intertwined with peace and the importance Chazal gave the candles that we light on Friday night. So that's for next week.